Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast is the multiverse, the skeptic's ultimate argument against the faith. Ken will explore the logic of the multiverse today in part one of two podcasts on this topic. Ken, as you know, the multiverse is often a card that the skeptic keeps in his back pocket just in case. And I know you've run into people on social media who have brought this argument up, and you have an article to bring to our attention as well.
Yeah, that's right, Joe. I really do think that just as Christian theists kind of gravitate toward arguments that we think support, you know, our worldview, I think that there are naturalists who gravitate toward arguments toward their worldview. And obviously, both of us live in the same universe, and both naturalists and Christian theists feel an obligation to try to explain this world and why we're here. And obviously, the multiverse is a potential explanatory theory for the naturalist. So what I want to do in this program is to talk a little bit about the multiverse, specifically a new article that I came across. And then we'll talk about what I think are strengths and also some, I think, very serious weaknesses when it comes to the multiverse.
All right, terrific. And I'm sure we have a resource or two to recommend. I know you've written on this topic, both in blog form and in your forthcoming book. So we'll look for those as well.
Yeah, and Dave, I'm gonna call on you from time to time because you're the expert, you're the physicist, and I'm simply a layman, and I may need your help. So, well, guys, I came across an article in the Scientific American, and Dave, I have a question about the Scientific American. Actually, it's scientificamerican.com. Dave, what kind of periodical is Scientific American? Can you tell us?
It's a scientific journal that has quite a high reputation. The people who write for it are selected by the editorial staff, who are, you know, working scientists, mathematicians, people who are active in the field. They're called upon to write articles that are more accessible by the layperson or by the non-expert scientist. You know, I for instance, you know, I'm knowledgeable in the area of physics, but I don't know biology as much. And so I can usually go to Scientific American and read articles on biology that are written by experts, but written in a way that I can access them, you know, quite effectively and understand what the issues are. I might also add that it tends to be rather secular in its approach to things. It's you know, I don't necessarily say it's liberal in the political sense, but, you know, they tend to take stands editorially that push against any kind of outside the boundary type scientific investigations or viewpoints.
Well, that's really helpful. I felt like it was very understandable and even for a non-scientist like myself. So thank you for that. Well, let me draw our readers, our listeners' attention to this article. It's entitled, "Our Improbable Existence is No Evidence for a Multiverse." That's the title. The subtitle is, "Experts in Probability Have Spotted a Logical Flaw in Theorists' Reading." And the author is Philip Goff. He is a philosopher and consciousness researcher at Durham University in the United Kingdom. And there is a a way of connecting with some of the things that he's written with the article. And Joe and Dave, I thought I would read a little bit of this article just to kind of set our discussion. And again, I'm going to stop at various points and ask Dave for clarification. And Joe, I want you to jump in as well. But let me read from the article. It says, "We exist and we are living creatures. It follows that the universe we live in must be compatible with the existence of life. However, as scientists have studied the fundamental principles that govern our universe, they have discovered that the odds of a universe like ours being compatible with life are astronomically low. We can model what the universe would have looked like if its constants, the strength of gravity, the mass of an electron, the cosmological constant, had been slightly different. What has become clear is that across a huge range of these constants, they had to have pretty much exactly the values they had in order for life to be possible. The physicist Lee Smolin has calculated that the odds of life compatible numbers coming up by chance is 1 in 10 to the 229th. I want to stop there for a moment and look at that that calculation. Again, I've heard the name Lee Smolin before. Life compatible numbers being by chance, again, 1 in 10 to the 229th. Dave, that's quite a bit higher than the number that I've heard Roger Penrose give. I think his is like 1 in 10 to the 123rd. Tell me a little bit about that number. I mean, it's a number I can't get my mind around.
Yeah, I think that the improbability is so small, or the probability, I guess, is so small, the improbability is so high, that that worrying about the difference between 10 to the 125 versus 10 to the 229 is sort of, you know, it just depends on what kind of assumptions have gone into it.
Okay.
It depends on, you know, how many parameters you decide to select to decide on, you know, what the final probability is. There's, you know, one probability that Hugh Ross frequently makes use of is the likelihood of there being the expansion rate of the universe at the value that it is, and it comes out to be something like this one part in 10 to the 60th or 10 to the 50th. And if you add other parameters in there, then of course that number climbs.
Okay.
So, you know, the key idea here is that it's very unlikely that all of these parameters would have the value that they have. This is, of course, the anthropic principle.
Yeah.
Just another way of stating it.
Well, I took as little mathematics in college as possible, but I know improbability when I see it.
Yeah.
And 1 in 10 to the 229th, I think that's improbable.
Yeah.
Well, let me read a little bit more of the article. It says, physicists refer to this discovery as the fine-tuning of physics for life. What should we make of it? Some take this to be evidence of nothing other than our good fortune, but many prominent scientists, Martin Rees, Alan Guth, Max Tegmark, have taken it to be evidence that we live in a multiverse, that our universe is just one of a huge, perhaps infinite ensemble of worlds. The hope is that this allows us to give a monkeys on typewriters explanation of the fine tuning. Now, Dave, what I find interesting here is Martin Rees. I think he's British. I think he's part of the United Kingdom.
Yeah, certainly. Martin Rees, actually.
Okay, Alan Guth, of course. I think he's at MIT.
Yes.
And I heard that Max Tegmark is now at Princeton. Is that? I know he was at MIT.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. How significant is this big three here, Rees, Guth, and Tegmark?
They're certainly the go-to people in in astrophysics and these kinds of issues. They are the experts. They've written on the subject and done research on the subject. So they certainly are the voices that one would go to answer questions with regard to multiverse.
Now, all three of them, I'm assuming, are atheists, naturalists. Does that sound right to you?
You know, I really don't know, to be honest, but my guess is that you're probably right.
I have listened to Max Tegmark, and one thing I really liked about him is I didn't sense any kind of worldview negation. That is, when I've listened to Max Tegmark in the past, he didn't seem to be anti-religious. He didn't necessarily seem to be receptive to it. But, you know, there are secular scientists who speak very critical of religion or theism. But I never got that from Tegmark, nor actually that much from Alan Guth either. They seem more interested in the science than they were in kind of philosophical worldview issues.
I would concur with that. I don't think any of these three are antagonistic against a religious worldview, particularly.
Very good. I want our listeners to know that, because, you know, they're, you know, we talk about Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss, and they tend to be very dismissive of a religious worldview. But the three that I've heard there, again, they may all be atheists, they may all be naturalists, but in their discussion, they seem to focus more on the science than philosophy. Well, let me read a bit more, because I think now Goth, the article of this, author of this article, gets into the multiverse. He says, "This explanation makes intuitive sense. However, experts in the mathematics of probability have identified the inference from the fine-tuning to the multiverse as an instance of fallacious reasoning. Specifically, multiverse theorists commit the inverse gambler's fallacy, which is a slight twist on the regular gambler's fallacy. In the regular gambler's fallacy, the gambler has been in a casino all night and has had a terrible run of luck. She thinks to herself, my next roll of the dice is bound to be a good one, as it's unlikely I'd roll badly all night. This is a fallacy because for any particular roll, the odds of, say, getting a double six are the same, 1 in 36. How many times the gambler has rolled that night has no bearing on whether the next roll will be a double six." Well, let me stop there, Joe and Dave. I'm familiar with the gambler's fallacy. It's kind of part of the false cause fallacy. And there's a variety of false causes, you know, post hoc ergo propter hoc, after this, therefore because of this, you know. Dave Rogstad sneezed, and then there was an earthquake in Chile. And so it was after Dave sneezed, therefore because of Dave sneezed. You know, it can be as silly as something like that, or it could be non causa pro causa, not the cause for the cause. I think just like philosophers, scientists have to be very careful about matching up cause and effect. And it can be tricky. So there is a fallacy called the false cause. Now, one of the varieties would be the gambler's fallacy. And I think Goff is right on here. You know, if you're a gambler, there's typically a mindset that comes with it, and that you go through streaks. So you go to Las Vegas or Atlantic City if you're in the East Coast, and you're throwing the dice and you've had a really bad string of luck. Well, there's a tendency on the gambler's mindset is to think that because I've been so unlucky, I'm due. It's my time.
Right.
Or, you know, if they've been very lucky, oh boy, maybe I had to get out. You know, it's about to turn. So the idea here is that this kind of mindset that I'm I'm in a bad streak. I've gone through a bad patch of gambling. Therefore, the next one is going to be the winner. That really is more of a psychological mindset. It doesn't change any of the actual probabilities. So if I've got two die in my hand and I roll them down and I'm looking for a double six, the probabilities don't change simply because I've had a bad streak or a good streak. So that's the basic fallacy of the gambler's fallacy, mm-hmm. that your experience doesn't change. So, you know, I still have the same probabilities. Now, let's go into this inverse idea. So let me read just a bit more and we'll stop and talk about that. Let's see here. It says, in the inverse gambler's fallacy, a visitor walks into a casino and the first thing she sees is someone rolling a double six. She thinks, wow, that person must have been playing for a long time, as it's unlikely they'd have such good luck just from one roll. This is fallacious for the same reason. The casino visitor has only observed one roll of the dice, and the odds of that one roll coming good is the same as any other roll, 1 in 36. How long the player has been rolling prior to this moment has no bearing on the odds of the one roll the visitor observed being a double six. So just as, hey, I've had a patch of bad luck, I'm due. If you walk into the casino and wow, the first roll, it's a double six, the person thinks, well, they must have been playing a long time, mm-hmm. because that's so unlikely. That's the inverse gambler's fallacy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, when you deal with probabilities, when you deal with things that are greatly improbable, a lot of times what's important is to look at the assumptions that people bring to the table. So just as the gambler's fallacy doesn't change the actual probability, that somebody would hit a very improbable number on the very first roll doesn't give a person a right to think, well, that had to, you know, they must have been here all weekend doing this kind of thing. So this is the criticism. Let me read just a bit more of the article. It says, some have objected that this argument against the inference from fine-tuning to a multiverse ignores the selection effect that exists in cases of fine tuning, namely that fact that we could not possibly have observed a universe that wasn't fine tuned. If the universe wasn't fine tuned, then life would be impossible. And so nobody would be around to observe anything. Now, guys, I hear that all the time. Whenever the multiverse issue comes up, somebody pipes up and says, well, of course the universe is fine-tuned. We wouldn't be here to observe it if it were not. Now, I think the best criticism of that selection effect idea has come from Richard Swinburne. Professor Swinburne is emeritus professor at Oxford. I would say he's one of the most significant Christian philosophers in the world, kind of competing with Alvin Plantinga for one of the most distinguished Christian philosophers. Swinburne says, you know, if there was a firing squad and, you know, so the poor guy who's going to get shot is standing there and they've got, you know, they've got six expert shots aiming at him and they fire and all the shots miss. And so somebody jumps out and says, what is the explanation for this? These guys are experts, but yet every shot missed. And so the guy standing there says, well, of course they all miss. I wouldn't be alive if it were not. What Swinburne says is the issue is not that you're still alive. The issue is, how is it possible for experts in firearms to have missed? What is the explanation? And Swinburne thinks that this is really missing the point. that you have to go right back to that question of why is the universe fine-tuned, or what happened in this shooting that we're here to observe is really kind of beside the point. Let me stop there. Does that make sense to you guys?
Yeah, Ken, I have a question for clarification on the gambler's fallacy. A lot of people play poker, so I just want to make sure you're distinguishing between going into a casino and rolling dice versus somebody who says, you know, I'm pretty good at poker. But there, would you agree that there are other elements? You're playing against other people, and you're not looking for a royal flush every time. You're just looking for a hand that could beat the other person, or maybe you're bluffing. So you're not talking about the same thing exactly there, right? As far as gambling, that's a different type of approach. You're talking about someone who's going to a machine, for lack of a better term, and expecting their outcome to change just because they've practiced it long enough.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I have to say, I'm not much of a gambler, and I don't know all the games that are played. I guess it's the roulette wheel, you know, or you're throwing the dice, or you're just, you know, pulling the handle on the machine. Again, not being an expert on gambling, I would say that even in poker, even though people say that there is a skill to it, you still don't have any, your skill doesn't affect the cards you get. So if you and I and Dave are gambling and everybody's on the up and up and, you know, we've got the deck there, you don't have any control over the cards you get. Mm-hmm. You know, you might be able to anticipate, well, I have two aces here, so he probably doesn't. But you still, I think the analogy that does run through the whole thing, Joe, is that if gambling is on the up and up and nobody's cheating, you don't have control over the cards that are coming your way, just as you don't have any control over, you know, the dots on the die.
Yeah, you got to play the hand that's been dealt you, right?
That's exactly right. And of course, Dave, I think what's interesting here, if I could bring a little philosophy to bear on our way of kind of thinking about the multiverse, that, you know, if you are a naturalist and you have basically said, well, the God explanation is just not one I'm willing to accept. They may think, you know, that just has no explanatory power. There's no reason to introduce God. I would think if you hold on multiverse, I mean, you would have to conclude that it's virtually a miracle. Now, not a miracle in a supernatural sense, but a virtual miracle in the natural world that everything came up just right.
That's right. Yeah, and, you know, I want to go back and just emphasize for people just to make sure that they understand why this is all coming up. Why are we talking about these probabilities? And that is that the naturalist is trying to come up with an explanation for this highly improbable universe. And he thinks that if there were a near infinite number of universes out there, that and the physics of each of those universes varied, so that the various parameters that we measure in our universe as being set to very precise values, that there would be in a large number of universes at least one, or if it's an infinite number, there would be actually an infinite number of universes that have these precise values. And so this is a real boon to the naturalist. He doesn't have to invoke God. He instead invokes this idea that there's all these universes out there. But of course, he realizes that he has to come up with some mechanism for why there are these universes out there. How did our universe come into existence? How did these others come into existence? And that's, of course, what this person that you're quoting here, Goth, is speaking to in this article, of what these mechanisms are and whether they really are legitimate.
So that's very critical. I'm so glad you provided that explanation. And I'm going to respond to it again as a layperson here that look, this fine tuning is so incredibly improbable. But if there is a whole world ensemble, if there's maybe a near infinite or infinite number of universes, then it's much more likely that one or more of those universes would have all of the necessary fine tuning. And so explaining this improbability, the mechanism of the multiverse gives us a sense of why one or more of those universes would have all of these things. Is that tracking? Okay.
Yes.
Joe, you want to jump in there?
I have another question for you. Do you suppose it's possible that in the mentality of the gambler, that person sees that in any other endeavor in life, you have to work at something and practice it and devote a lot of hours to something to get good at it, and eventually things will go the way you hope they will, whether that's in a job, a sporting adventure, or picking up a musical instrument. You know, you practice over and over and then you get good at it. Could that be part of the mentality that a gambler might have? It's like, you know, if I go at this long enough, the luck's going to break my way. I know you say the odds don't change, but you think the mentality kind of goes through there?
I think so. I mean, I have never been a gambler. I have known a few people that gambled. It does seem to me that they have a tendency to think it's not merely the probability or improbability of the cards or of the dice. I think they often do think, I'm a professional gambler, therefore I've kind of mastered my craft. And I would think, as I've watched people talk about playing poker, that sometimes you have a tell when you're playing poker. When you've got a good hand, you have a tell. You know, you might scratch your ear, or you might do something that these professional gamblers are. Joe's got a good hand. He's tipping it off by his tell. Or we also know that gamblers, particularly card players, can bluff. Hey, I'm all in, man. Let's do it. Having said all of that, and again, I'm not in a good position to evaluate how much skill comes into gambling, I do want to raise some questions about that. And that is, it seems to me that the vast majority of people don't do well at gambling, even with that mentality. And it seems to me, Joe and Dave, that gamblers often live in a magical world. They don't pay attention, I think, enough to statistical probabilities. I think that's why we call it the gambler's fallacy. They think that this is all about them. Mm-hmm. And since they've had such a bad stretch, well, you know that next card is going to be the winner. And I have talked with people who have gone to Vegas and think that way. So I think the gambler's fallacy is that this is a magical way of thinking. And if you just draw out the mathematical statistics, if I flip a coin five times in a row, a quarter, the first four come out to heads, I know this is going to be tails. But statistically, if the flip is fair, that fifth flip is still 50-50. Mm-hmm. Now, let me read a little bit more, because I want Dave to kind of help us to think about the potential evidence for a multiverse. Goff says, but isn't there scientific evidence for a multiverse? Some physicists do indeed think there is a tentative empirical evidence for a kind of multiverse that described by the hypothesis of eternal inflation. According to internal inflation, there is a vast, exponentially expanding mega space in which certain regions slow down to form bubble universes, our universe being one such bubble universe. However, there is no empirical ground for thinking that the constants of physics, the strength of gravity, the mass of electrons, etc., are different in these different bubble universes. And without such variation, the fine-tuning problem is even worse. We now have a huge number of monkeys, all of whom are typing English. So, Dave, can you give us a little, hopefully, explanation of internal inflation that lay people like me can understand?
No.
Okay, thank you very much.
But I just the comment that, you know, as I said earlier, the idea that there's an infinite number of universes out there is very appealing as an explanation for our own universe.
Okay.
But of course, the scientist has to come up with an explanation for why there are these infinite number or large infinite, you know, nearly infinite number of universes. And inflation has been the appeal here.
Okay.
Trying to get our hands around, our arms around what inflation really is, I find extremely difficult. And I wouldn't want to even attempt it.
Okay.
But it's somehow an idea that a mechanism that they think has been active in producing some very important properties of our own universe. The Big Bang inflationary model is the model that is pretty well accepted as an explanation for why our universe right now is the way that it is, as far as its homogeneity and its, other factors that are important. So inflation is an important idea that now has this added application. Maybe okay. Inflation, which has worked very well in explaining the Big Bang, can now be used to explain these universes. But as this writer pointed out, it explains the fact that you might have these universes, but it doesn't explain the fact that they have different physical parameters. So okay. They've got part of the problem solved, but not the whole problem.
Okay, just two more paragraphs here. They're fairly short, but Dave, I want you to comment on this one. Goff says, at this point, many bring in string theory. String theory offers a way to make sense of the possibility that the different bubbles might have different constants. On string theory, the supposedly fixed number of physics are determined by the phase of space, and there are 10 to the 500th different possible phases of space in the so-called string landscape. It could be that random processes ensure that a wide variety of possibilities from the string landscape are realized in different bubble universes. Again, however, there is no empirical reason for thinking that this is possibly actual. David, can you give us a little clarification on what string theory helps or doesn't help when it comes to the multiverse?
Yeah, string theory is a development in recent years, where in very simple terms, instead of thinking of the elementary particles that we believe exist and explain the physics of our universe, instead of thinking of them as just points with zero dimension, and then using that to give theories about why quantum mechanics works and why the particles, how they interact and all of that kind of thing. The problem with thinking of them as points is that in certain mathematical implementations of this theory, thinking of them as points creates what are called singularities. It's where the mathematics goes to infinity because you have single zero dimensional points that the mathematics doesn't work correctly when you go down to that small a size. And so the idea here is to give these elementary particles at least one dimension. a string instead of a point. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the theory speaks of these strings as vibrating in different ways to represent the different particles. So it's a theory that has a lot of hope for being a theory of everything, because not only does it eliminate these singularities, but it also offers the opportunity of unifying gravity and quantum mechanics, which has been a continuing problem for at least 100 years. Mm-hmm. And so there's, people really enthusiastic, or at least some are, but it's very difficult to calculate things in this theory, very difficult. It's a very complicated theory, and there is no really strong evidence to support it. It's mathematically very pleasing, but its connection to reality is tenuous at best. And so that's the problem. Here you have perhaps an explanation that could provide a way to explain why these universes out there have different physics, but you're using a theory that many astrophysicists would argue is metaphysics instead of physics. It's not tied to reality. It's not testable.
Okay, that's a very important point, and I want to come back to that a little bit later. Let me read the final paragraph here. This is Philip Goff. He's a philosopher and consciousness researcher at Durham University in the United Kingdom. And this is from the scientificamerican.com. Our improbable existence is no evidence for a multiverse. Well, Goff finally concludes. He says, quote, "The reason some scientists take seriously the possibility of a multiverse in which the constants vary in different universes is that it seems to explain the fine-tuning. But on closer examination, the inference from fine-tuning to the multiverse proves to be an instance of flawed reasoning. So what should we make of the fine-tuning? Perhaps there is some other way of explaining it, or perhaps we just got lucky." There's a lot there that I'd like to kind of talk a little bit about. And then probably in our next program, I'm going to talk about some of the criticisms that I list in my new book manuscript about the multiverse. But what's interesting here is, Dave, I guess the first point I'd like you to confirm is that fine-tuning is no longer a controversial idea in science. It sounds like everybody recognizes that, there are all these dials that seem to be just right for life. So am I right to say it's no longer a controversial idea in science?
Yes, I believe that's correct.
Here is a philosopher who says, well, look, here is this potential mathematical explanation, but he says it's based upon flawed reasoning. And he then says, perhaps there is some other way of explaining it, or perhaps we just got lucky. I guess the point I want to bring up at this stage is to simply say this, that, and Joe, this kind of comes back to something you started off the podcast with. It does seem that a worldview has certain kind of essential components to it, and that there are potential defeaters for a particular worldview. So let me talk just briefly about what a defeater is, that every conceivable worldview may contain within it ideas that are logically incoherent and catastrophic. I mean, it seems to me, I think it's a fair reading. In fact, I think Paul is very explicit about it, that the Apostle Paul indicates that if Jesus isn't risen from the dead, then Christianity is done. That is, if you're a Christian and we discover the body, or somehow the resurrection view is shown to be false, then that would defeat our belief in Christianity. Now, there may be other things, some might suggest, for example, if the universe doesn't have a beginning, if the universe weren't created, that would be a potential defeater for Christianity. I'm less certain to take that on, but I think there may be some truth to that. So let me now shift over to naturalism. And Dave and Joe, I'd like you to give me your thoughts here. It seems to me, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, it seems to me that maybe the reason why naturalists, atheists, secularists, the reason they hold so strongly to evolution, unguided naturalistic evolution, is that it's the only game in town. That is, if you're a naturalist, if you're an atheist, you have to explain, or at least you have to try to reason, to offer some explanation of why there is so much life, why complex life. So you need some kind of explanatory theory, and evolution seems to be the only naturalistic explanation. So you're stuck. I mean, you probably don't want to say the Martians did it. And you definitely don't want to say the big man in the sky did it. So, you know, I've often wondered, why are naturalists so tenacious about evolution? Well, it may be the reason why Christians are so tenacious about the resurrection, because it all hinges there. And I guess, Dave, I would want to say, maybe the big picture, just as evolution is the explanation for why we have complex life in our world, that maybe the multiverse is the even bigger explanation of why there is our universe and other things. Do you think I'm right about that? Or
yeah, I think there's an analogy here that the naturalist is, of course, grasping for naturalistic explanations for the peculiar things that we see in our universe, life being one of them, and the fine-tuning being the other. And, you know, the fact that there is this fine-tuning and we live in such an improbable universe that life could exist must indicate, in their view, from a naturalistic perspective, must indicate that there's lots of other universes out there that we can select from. And the problem that they're facing, of course, is there's no evidence for it. Mm-hmm. And so then they're grasping for mathematical theories like string theory to provide some evidence, but many have pointed out that it's unprovable, at least so far. And the other piece of evidence that they're grasping for is, well, we're here, aren't we? Mm-hmm. So there must be some out there. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So it's just kind of a, like you've pointed out, or like Goff has pointed out, it's a probability argument that actually is false.
So for our non-science listeners like me, you know, this number, Lee Smolin's number, 1 in 10 to the 229th, to explain the fine-tuning, this is such an incredible number. But if you postulate a world ensemble, if you postulate a multiverse, then you have a near virtual, near infinite number of universes. Well, then it makes it much more likely that one or more of those would have this necessary fine-tuning. And so the inexplicability of the probabilities is made more, you can more reasonably entertain it.
That's right. By the way, just to comment about evolution,
yeah,
the same thing is true there, in the sense that they are looking for evidence to support an evolutionary paradigm. Mm-hmm. And in the case of evolution, there is some level of support. Mm-hmm. We certainly have what we call microevolution. We experience or see that kind of evidence that supports the idea that there is evolution. The question is whether that carries over into what we call macroevolution. Can we really explain the diversity of life on the Earth by an evolutionary theory? And there, that's where the big battle occurs. It, you know, the naturalist says, oh yes, we see it on the fine level. We think we see evidence of it on the big level, and therefore it's the right theory. But there are skeptics, not necessarily religious skeptics only, but even naturalist skeptics who question whether this mechanism really can serve to account for the diversity of life. But at least in the case of evolution, there is some evidence. Mm-hmm. So it has some provability or some testability that you know, supports it. But in the case of the multiverse, we so far have no evidence.
Now, again, I want to come back to that, and that'll take us into another program. But Dave, let's, you know, here we again have these prominent scientists, Martin Rees, Alan Guth, Max Tegmark. Again, we're not sure. Rees, Guth, and Tegmark aren't nearly as outspoken in their philosophical worldview ideas. They maybe all three are atheistic naturalists to the core, but I think it's fair to say that some scientists play, you know, are not as candid about what they believe philosophically, and maybe they're more concerned with trying to get the science right or get the math right. But you know, if I can do a little assuming here, hopefully not unreasonable assuming, you know, if Rees, Guth, and Tegmark are looking at the world and they see that fine tuning is no longer controversial, then they're asking, well, what could conceivably be a naturalistic explanation for this? And if they think there is no other explanation, you know, I'm not willing to, let's say, I'm not willing to entertain the idea that there's a God. I'm not willing to entertain metaphysical explanations, although in the next program, I'm going to suggest that the multiverse might qualify as a metaphysical explanation, but we'll deal with that then. Is it possible, Dave, to say that this speculation fits because it may be the only explanation that seems fairly reasonable?
It does seem that that's the case, yes. I think that's the... I don't know of any other game in town, as it were. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean to say that there couldn't be, as Goth in his article points out, maybe there will be some explanation, but the one that is presently used to justify it is not there, is not sufficient.
Okay, let me come, I want to dig a little deeper on that, and then I have another point that I want to raise with you guys. The other day I was thinking to myself, there is a national cemetery not too far from where I live. So it's the national cemetery in the Riverside County, the city of Riverside. And it's equivalent to what Arlington Cemetery is in Washington, D.C., or actually in Virginia. And so, you know, I like to go over there, and they have various things, of course, dedicated to the veterans that are buried there. And they even have a part of the museum that's dedicated to Medal of Honor winners. And I'll go over there and read the names, and I find that very interesting. But one of the things I like about cemeteries is I feel like I'm singularly alone with my thoughts in a cemetery. And I don't find that easy to do all the time. I mean, I probably do a lot better than a lot of people in a pandemic because I'm kind of closed off anyway. I'm an introvert. I like being alone with my thoughts. Now, Pascal says most people don't. In fact, there was a study done of college students who said they'd rather be shocked than be alone with their thoughts without their cell phone. Well, I have a flip phone and it doesn't take pictures and I hardly ever use it. So I'm not afraid of being alone with my thoughts, but in fact, I'd like to be more alone with my thoughts. And I find that going to the cemetery, nothing's competing with what's happening to me in my mind. But you know, the last time I was there, I thought to myself, well, there's a lot of dead people here. And I'm going to be one of them if time takes its course. What at the end of my life, what would I say about why I believe what I believe? I mean, if it came right down to it, if push came to shove, so to speak, Ken, why do you believe? And the answer that I've come up with is that I think that Christianity provides the best explanation. Christian theism provides the best explanation for the most meaningful things in life. And I think that applies to the cosmos, why it had an origin, why it's designed, why it's fine-tuned. I think it extends to me, myself, why I have many good qualities, but why I'm flawed morally. I think it explains things like numbers and logic and abstractions. And then maybe most importantly, it explains the person of Jesus Christ and why he could perform miracles and why he conquered death. And so, you know, here I am in a cemetery and I'm thinking to myself, so when it comes right to it, I mean, a lot of us don't like to think about the fact that we're going to die, but I've always wanted to think about it because I was hoping that by being as authentic and living authentically, maybe I would learn something profound about death that I could then apply to life. And so I don't want to be at the end of my life and then going through a process of saying, God, I don't even know why I believe what I believe. Now, if that's right, I mean, if Ken Samples goes to the National Cemetery here in Riverside, California, and I think about the question, why do I believe what I believe? And I come to the conclusion that Christian theism provides the best explanation for the most meaningful realities of life. Dave, what are the odds that somebody like Reese, Guth, and Techmark, are they going to think that way? Or are they going to say, well, now, granted, these three men are not philosophers. They are like you. They're math science people. I guess my question is this, are they all in on a multiverse? Or would they say, hey, I'm a secularist? Now, again, I'm not really asking about Reese, Guth, and Techmark. I'm really asking about the basic secular scientist. Do you think they would do what I would do and say, well, the complexity in life, well, maybe a multiverse. What do you think?
Boy, I don't know. My experience with the atheists is that they are happy to use explanations for things like fine-tuning, for instance, being the multiverse, and don't worry nearly so much about some of the other areas that need explaining, okay, which you mentioned in your little comments here. For instance, why human beings are both good and evil at the same time, or why there are, you know, moral principles in the world, or, you know, some of these other areas that we feel are also important to explain. They just don't worry about those kinds of things because they're basically good people. They're not people who are troubled. You know, they live probably pretty good lives. They're successful in their careers. So they just don't think about, you know, what's going to happen when I die? You know, yeah. Am I going to eventually have to be accountable for all of, you know, my viewpoints and so on? Or I'm a pretty good person. So even if I have to stand before a God someday, I'll be able to, you know, have all, you know, the necessary explanations and be able to challenge this God. I don't know. I just think that's my experience with people. There's also a lot of people who would accept a multiverse view from a scientific perspective and still believe that there could be a God. Mm-hmm. They just don't think of him as necessarily the creator in the same way that a Christian does.
Now, you both are familiar with the famous quote from Socrates, "The unexamined life is not worth living." I was reading one philosopher and he said, "The over-examined life is also not worth living." I have found that, I found actually very few people I know go to the cemetery to be alone with their thoughts.
Yeah.
So I may be an oddball. That doesn't surprise you and Joe, but so, you know, I think your point is a very good one, Dave, and that is, you know, these are three very successful scientists. They have had very successful careers at things that they love. And I would imagine all three of them have a certain level of celebrity, although, you know, they may not be followed around like Michael Jordan or somebody like that. But I guess the question is, how philosophical is the multiverse? I mean, how is that such an important explanation as that it provides this big picture explanation of reality? And maybe you've already commented on that.
Yeah, I guess I think that it probably is important for them.
Okay.
I mean, you know, Dawkins says that atheism evolution provides sort of a satisfaction to him as an atheist for explaining life here on the earth and the diversity of life. So obviously Dawkins holds his view of atheism in spite of evidence contrary to it. But when he finds evidence to support it, it makes him feel good. So, you know, there obviously is some concerns that he has that are nagging at him, but it doesn't seem to necessarily dictate whether he is an atheist or not, or a naturalist or not. He's a naturalist for other reasons, and now he's looking for evidence to support it. And my guess is that these people are in that same category. Okay. They happen to be not worried about evolution. They're worried about fine tuning. And so their explanations that are, you know, marginal are in the form of multiverse.
Yeah.
By the way, the multiverse, a number of years ago, I wrote a little blog on a biologist that was using multiverse kind of thinking to explain some of the very peculiar things that we see in the way in which life progresses, and some of the improbabilities of DNA and yeah, various other things in the cells of life. And, you know, really what it comes down to is you can explain anything with multiverse, no matter how improbable something would be. You can say, well, there's at least one universe in which this could happen. I also find it interesting that a lot of the science fiction shows that appear on TV now I think of, say, for instance, this program called Flash, where mm-hmm. that guy can run super fast. Yeah. Or there's the new Star Trek Discovery program. They're all making appeals to multiverse and parallel universes and people in those other universes that are like us, but maybe have slight different characteristics. Maybe they're evil and we're good, or it's just remarkable how this has kind of permeated our society in so many different ways.
Now I want to touch on one more logical point, Joe, and then I'd like to give some resources. Dave and Joe, what I thought was really interesting about this article was that, again, if I could go back to the title of the article that I find interesting, the title is "Our Improbable Existence is No Evidence for a Multiverse." And then here's the subtitle: "Experts in Probability Have Spotted a Logical Flaw in Theorists' Reasoning." I guess the point I want to make there is, as a student of logic and as a professor of logic, it's interesting to me that scientists still care very much about basic reasoning. You know, they may have a theory, but if that theory has a fallacious breakdown, it counts against it. So science, which, you know, again, I'm not a scientist, and I may not always understand exactly how science is done, but it seems very empirical to me, although the multiverse doesn't seem empirical to me. But if there is a logical flaw in something, Dave, that's a red flag to scientists.
Should be, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
But unfortunately, people are not so readily willing to give up just because there seems to be a flaw, and they'll work pretty hard to figure out a way around it.
Okay, Joe, you have questions, or you want to make a point before we talk a little bit about the resources we have?
I'm listening with ears that are burning. I appreciate it. All I know is I'm not going to go to Vegas anytime soon. That's a lesson I've learned here. Thank you.
Well, I have a new book that's going to come out soon, Christianity Cross-Examined, and I have a chapter on the question of who made God. If God made the world, then who made God? And part of that chapter has a section that I call My Musings on the Multiverse. We're going to approach that in the next show, which will again focus on the multiverse. But I also want to mention that Jeff Swearink, who is an astrophysicist, who is a senior scholar at Reasons to Believe, has written a book on this topic, Who's Afraid of the Multiverse? And Joe, I think there are a number of blog articles, either by me or Jeff or Hugh, that address this topic. And so there is quite a bit of articles and things that we have available.
Yeah. Also, Jeff's more recent book, Escaping the Beginning, is also a good one on this topic.
Right. Very good.
All right, Ken. Well,
I'll turn it over to you, Joe.
Looking forward to hearing more in the next podcast. We sure hope you will as well. Thanks for listening to this one. Let us know your comments and questions. In fact, Ken and Dave, a couple of comments have come through. I'd like to read them for us. Professor Samples, I listen to you on the RTB podcast often. You break things down and bring clarity to apologetics questions. Thank you. Mm. That's from Patrick Henderson. Here's another comment. I'm always encouraged at how well you handle different discussions, no matter if they are difficult or bizarre, you approach with grace and truth. That's Christ at work. God bless. Brian Earl Spear from Facebook. Thank you to Brian and Patrick for those generous comments. Please keep them coming. You can reach Ken, obviously, on Facebook. You also have your blog, Reflections by Ken. WordPress.com. I know people have commented there. And also you can find Ken here at his RTB handle at RTB_KSamples. So thanks for those comments. Keep them coming. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Look for the Reasons to Believe podcast and you'll find Straight Thinking there. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.